5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Tell the Damn Story. We're here, and I'm Chris Ryan. He's Alex Simmons, the legend, the creator of, well, probably all things, but at the very least, wonderful stories featuring some of your favorite characters that I may or may not be legally allowed to say. And of course, the mythic Aaron Day, also known as Blackjack, 1930s soldier of fortune, globetrotting adventurer that Alex has been writing for years and winning awards for. And he's so many other things. He has created Kids Comic Con, and he teaches film, and he teaches writing, and he taught me how to tie my shoes. It's so many things that make Alex Simmons. There he is, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, now you're only wearing loafers. Thank you.
That's right. Mr. I'm wearing a Mr. loafer Chris right Burrow. Now.
What have you done with my Chris? Yes, okay. Yeah, thank you. Loafer. Okay, so... thank you very much, Chris, for that wonderful introduction. And I will reciprocate by saying, ladies and gentlemen, on the other side of the microphone is Mr. Christopher Ryan, Chris to his boys, his homies, his friends, his pals, his fans. And Chris, and I'll just make it very concise, taught for 30 years and churned out several very successful young writers who are out there putting their fingerprints on the world and bringing all kinds of creative revelations to the masses. So thank you for that, Chris. Also has been a diligent pursuer of his own writing craft and has written a number of mystery books, science fiction stories, assassin stories, just you name it, he's done it. And has been also a not only an independent writer, but an independent publisher who has a production or a publishing experience now, because it's 5 or almost 6 volumes.
Almost six.
Almost six. And this is...
talking to our guest today about helping...
Yeah. Get your pen out, folks, because I'm about to hit you with a new word here. If you haven't been listening to the show before this, Soul Scream Anthologazine.
Yeah.
That's the title of the project. Soul Scream. You've heard Soul. You've heard Scream. Soul Scream Anthologazine. That's a new word that he created because he's a wordsmith. So that is Mr. Christopher Ryan. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing really fine. Another friend of our show, Bobby Nash, put on, he was so pleased with some nominations he got from the Pulp Factory. And two of the nominations tie into Soul Scream Anthologazine, Science Run Amok. I'm pretty excited about that.
It's one of the 5 or 6 volumes, right?
That's volume number 5, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go. There you go.
And... It allows us to go right into our introduction today because, while Bobby Nash is holding down the South and writing everything down there, the rest of the universe has to rely on this guy who is a writing machine, a good friend, nice guy, great. I cannot believe the output, and we're going to talk about that today. Ladies and gentlemen, the writer of, is it 4 or 500?
Actually, at this point, it's 477 manuscripts.
All right, 477 manuscripts, stories in some stories form.
In a week.
Anomaly. Right.
No. And we're going to talk about...
his output.
The output, the stuff that's coming just in 2024. We've been hitting that 2024 theme. But ladies and gentlemen, any excuse to talk to this gentleman is exciting. Can you please help me welcome Teal James Glenn? How are you, sir?
And the crowd goes mild.
How you doing, Teal?
I'm doing fine. I'm amazed, A, that I'm still here. Every day I feel that way.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know how Chris was able to get his younger brother to do this podcast, though, and fill in for him.
Yeah, just a new look for 2024. We don't know how long it'll last.
If you get too aerodynamic, you got to be careful.
That's right.
You could run into the Speed Force, and that would mess things up for the timeline. Wow.
There was a couple of great reactions when I did this. The dog went, double take.
At one point, I had shoulder-length hair and a full mustache, and I look like a goatee. I look like Buffalo Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I was cast as Frankenstein, in a musical out in Reno, Nevada. And they were going to put this headpiece on me, but we were doing 3 90-minute shows a day. I said, I'll die from heat prostration. So I said, I'll shave my head. I had a friend that was passing through the city, staying at my place, and they're in the other room. And I went in, shaved my head. I came out and he went, oh my God, you went from Buffalo Bill to John L. Sullivan. And it was like, John, it was very free.
Of an actor. Yes.
You know?
Yul Brynner. Yes.
Yeah, look, at one point, all we had was Yul Brynner, but then we had Patrick Stewart and Vin Diesel. It's okay now.
Wait a minute, wait. Okay. How can you leave out Telly?
And Telly.
That loves you, baby.
What was that?
Baby. Maybe not Teal.
So, one more. This is a quick one. I'm sorry, Chris. I had to do this. Quick one. Black actor, 1960s, muscular, Tarzan film.
Oh, Woody Strode.
There you go. Okay. Another bald person. Lord. There you go. Okay.
Yeah. Well, okay, not to mention.
We're back. Chris. We're back.
Isaac Hayes, man.
No.
The coolest. Okay,
right. We're back, Chris. Go ahead.
So it took the two of them 2 minutes and 18 seconds to climb into the time machine. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the dangers in this episode is that Teal and Alex are both time travelers. So we are going to be every once in a while slipping away from 2024 and sliding into the 60s, the 70s, the 40s, the 30s. It's just nothing I can do about it.
Okay.
Excuse me, it was some of the turbulence from the time travel. Teal, one of the things we're going to talk about, the theme, I guess, for today is productivity. And we're going to do it by visiting your upcoming projects, the things that are coming out in 2024. And so far, now, ladies and gentlemen, this number might change during the show because Teal is writing with one hand while we're doing the show here. But right now we're going to find out the status of a book. I can't wait to get my hands on The Pulp Guy, Book of Pulp Heroes. Is that the correct title?
Yep.
Right? So that's one.
Yep.
And then we have 19 anthologies that Teal is going to appear in 2024. And then we have something we're going to talk about called Paradise Investigations. So there's a ton of things happening. We're going to hear a lot. And Alex is already waiting to go back to 1958. Well, so you don't know what's going to happen today. Here's Alex.
Now, I will just say that actually, folks, listen long and hard to this, because aside from just being amazed at the amount of material this person turns out, it is definitely about maintaining your creativity and how you can be prolific, especially when I know a number of you might struggle with where's the next idea coming from, mm-hmm. or how do I not judge my ideas, or how do I build on whatever the genre is that my thought is coming from. So there's a lot to be gained from this episode, aside from the silly things we're going to be talking about. So go ahead.
Yes.
Let me just say what you were saying there. Anyone who thinks my idea isn't good enough, they've made 5 Sharknado movies. Any idea you can come up with, it's how well you write it, not even the idea, because every idea has already been done.
Mm.
It's true. It's just your version of it. Bring yourself to it.
Yeah.
Proofread, damn it. So I'd like to start. I've heard about this a couple of times in whispers and awed masses, and it's kind of, Teal, tell us a little bit, if you can, about The Pulp Guy's Book of Pulp Heroes, which I'm really excited about.
This started as a column I wrote years ago for an online website, and which was about all things pulp and old adventure books and whatever. And so I wrote a weekly column for a year.
Where did it appear?
Illiterati was the title of the website.
How about that?
I know. Totally. And what was funny, because that sounds like it's highfalutin, but it was about Tarzan. And it was totally about stuff people actually are interested in, not dissecting Greek plays.
Yeah.
And then the website passed away, as all things do, all things flesh and electronic. And it's... The column sat, including a bunch that had not been published. And after a while, I said, I really like this stuff, because I do. I'm obsessed with this stuff. Anything that I like today, I often, where did that come from? So I go back to, oh, this was the first version of that was remade as that or was inspired by that. So I just compiled it and rewrote all of it, expanded it. But it's, I think it's 48 chapters on a rough history of the pulps through the main characters. There's a chapter on, say, The Shadow, which who started the big pulp boom in 1930. But then there's a bunch of chapters on all of the Shadow imitators. And then there's a chapter on specific, the bigger ones, like The Spider got his own chapter.
Right.
But then there's chapters on Johnston McCulley's Zorro. But then there's a, that is also, then there's a whole chapter on the like 20 other Johnston McCulley masked heroes, including right. his own ripoff of his Zorro called Alias the Whirlwind. And, but I do it in roughly chronological order. There's like all of the Air Aces, all of the masked heroes, all of the,
military characters.
I go to some of the military characters, some of Captain Battle and his Air Aces, but like G8 and the Battle Aces,
sure.
but not too many of those per se, because once the war hit, there were so many series and they were not, they were almost all carbon copies of each other. So it right. tends to be the more outrageous heroes and some of the villains, Wu Fang and the Scorpion and the Skull Killer, who were like only maybe had an issue or two. And then things like, people forget there was a Flash Gordon pulp for two issues. There was, yep, I'll get Pam. There was a Flash Gordon pulp. There was a Lone Ranger pulp. Wow. For issues. People don't think of them as pulp characters because they originated in other forms. And Buck Rogers.
Sure.
Buck Rogers started as two novels or two novelettes in a fantasy and science, in a Amazing magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So technically it's Buck Rogers is a pulp hero, even though he wasn't called Buck in the magazines. And then Conan and all of Robert E. Howard's characters. Today, by the way, is Robert E. Howard's birthday, the 22nd of January.
Happy birthday, Bobby.
Yeah,
Bobby
Keith. He's the man. Yeah. And it's talk about productivity. He had less than 10 years of writing life, right. and they're still finding manuscripts of his that were not published. They're still finding stuff that's just coming into print now. And he did it on a manual typewriter in the heat of Texas.
Mm. And there's a verve and energy that still sings off the pages today.
Yeah. When you read the L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter and a bunch of other people edited his stuff, often watering it down, often taking the energy out. When you read the unexplurged original material of his, it leaps off the page.
Yeah.
It just jumps at you with the energy of it. And when I need to recharge, I go back and I'll read a short story, Beyond mm-hmm. the Black River or Dark Agnes. And I'm like, okay, this is how it's supposed to be done.
Just remind me towards the end of this episode, I want to go back to what you were just talking about. Don't want to derail you now.
Oh, no, in the time machine.
No, this is not time, but this is about removing the energy from a writer's work. And since you were talking very specifically about this, I would just like to explore that a little bit in terms of a different conversation.
In terms of what Lynn Carter and L. Sprague did, do you want to go from there? We've brought it up.
They would often soften phrases. They would, particularly when they were doing things like they rewrote a bunch of his Crusader tales to be Conan tales.
Right.
And in doing so, I had to change names and places, but they would also change some of the descriptions. And I was talking to a friend last night, his poetry, people forget he was an incredible poet. And that infused his prose.
Mm-hmm.
He had a love and a richness. In high school, I was the only kid who not only liked it, but read it twice, The Scarlet Letter.
Mm-hmm.
And because the language was so beautiful, the story, but the language was so exquisite that I could see, story-wise, I could see why most people feel like they're being sentenced to reading the book. But for someone who loved Poe, reading that language, even if it was characters I didn't care about, the language was so rich, I came to care about the actual framework the characters were in almost more than the characters in some cases.
And you're saying that these editors took that out of Howard's
They work? Took a lot. Yes, they did. They softened some of the brutality. The thing about Conan, and people forget, he'd stopped writing Conan years before his death. He stopped writing Conan and was on to historical tales because that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah,
he really He really was not that interested in doing Hyborian tales, but he wrote stuff and it wouldn't sell, so he'd put a monster in it, and he could sell it to Weird Tales. Right. But eventually, he got on to writing pure historical adventure tales about crusaders, and his Red Sonja was with a Y. She was a one in one story about the siege of Vienna. She didn't wear a chainmail bikini. She was this big, broad, buxom, Eastern European woman who could outdrink the guys on the battlements, and was much more of Tugboat Annie than she was Raquel Welch.
I went out drinking with a girl like that one time.
Yeah.
I had to flee. I couldn't handle it. Boy, two or three beers for my one. Yes, yeah, that was a Red Sonja type.
Yeah, she totally was. And she was there to revenge her sister because her sister fell in love with an Ottoman. And she was like, we can't have that in our family. So she was going to kill every Turk she could. So, but anyway, when Carter and DeCamp edited it, they both had literary backgrounds.
Right.
And academic literary backgrounds. And they started to impose academic rules in some of the sentence construction where Howard was completely self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
He was writing Howard Bonics. He was writing his own, and yet based on the fact that he read every book he could get his hands on, he used to break into libraries, read the books during the summer and put them back when he was finished. And librarians knew and didn't care because he just could not get enough.
Yeah.
But he was writing historicals. If you could take Raphael Sabatini's historicals and give them caffeine, that's what he wrote.
There you go.
There was just energy and verb in everything. Many of his stories start right in the middle. It would slap you in the face, and then you catch up. And
as it should be.
Yeah, I think so. I believe in bitch slapping the audience in the first sentence or two, and then they'll listen. There's the old joke about farmers trying to get this donkey to move, and it's just sitting there, and he's yanking on a guy comes and he starts to pick up a stick, and he's whacking the donkey. Guy says, "Hey, you can't do that. You got to reason with him." He takes the stick from the farmer, turns around, whacks the donkey once on the head. The guy says, "Hey, wait a minute! What, you said you had to reason with him?" "Yeah, but you got to get his attention first." And to me, that's the theory of writing. If I can't grab you in that first sentence, if I can't grab you in that first paragraph for a novel, even a first sentence for a novel would be great, but usually you need a little more because your novels have multiple layers. You can't just take the one sentence. But if I can't grab you by the end of that first page for a novel, then I don't deserve to have your clientele.
Yeah.
And I think too many people, an editor I know, P.N. Elrod, her big thing is she's, please God, don't start another story with a character waking up.
Right.
And or dream sequence. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, because it's been done so much, it has no energy anymore.
Right. Unless, of course, you started with a splash, a bucket of water on someone when he's in the middle of being tortured. And technically, he woke up. Well, but it's not the same thing.
I said, there were three rules to writing a novel, but no one knows what they are.
Yeah, that's right.
And any rule anyone can make up, absolutely you can contradict.
It's just so you take the trope and you say, how can I make it fresh?
Right? Yes, exactly. And that's, again, that's why I say, don't worry about your story. If I have a story about a bunch of people traveling somewhere with a criminal and they're attacked by people, And it turns out the criminal is the only one who has the means and agency to save them all. And he proves he's a good guy. That has been done a billion times.
Right.
But it had even been done a billion times before Stagecoach was made.
Right.
But it made Stagecoach work. And then it made science fiction movies work. And it made everything
Pitch
else work.
Black.
Yeah, which we'll talk about that off camera. But that is how you change it. How do you... Edgar Rice Burroughs said, when you use a plot, don't throw it away.
Right.
Change the location of the characters, and it's perfectly usable. So right. I wrote three short stories with exactly the same plot. One is a Western, one is a contemporary adventure, and one is a sword and sorcery.
Right.
Before, and it's got a very simple twist in the original story. Before you're 10% into it, it's a completely different story. But if I use that, if you reduce it to just a one sentence outline or a two sentence outline of that story, it sounds exactly the same. A bunch of people trapped at a location with a killer who doesn't know which one of them he's supposed to kill until his boss gets there. That was also the episode of Paladin. That was also an episode of THE Cat. That was also an episode of Starsky and Hutch. But what you do with the characters, what you do with the characters completely change the nature of it, and usually then will change the ending.
Yeah,
I have to take
story comes out of
derailing the original course of this thing, which is why I was saying I was going to wait until the end. So where were we when we really
we were talking about the Pulp Guy book.
Okay, there you go.
The Pulp Guy book of pulp heroes. When is it expected to come out?
It's coming out from Bold Venture Press at this point, probably beginning of summer.
Okay, great.
The thing is, it is Rich who's compiling that. There's a lot of illustrations, and it's massive. I'm hoping it becomes the I gotta have it on my shelf.
The coffee table kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll go coffee table. He was talking about possibly doing a hardcover, but certainly for anyone who's interested in popular heroes. Not just pulp heroes, because I go into, for instance, I'll use Buck Rogers as an example. I go into the original pulp, then I go into the newspaper, and then I go into the serial, then I go into the television show.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, and there was a series of films before the serial. There were three short, like 5-minute, 8-minute films that were shown at the World's Fair that were with the costume designs directly from the comic book. From the newspaper strip. So I'll take the character and I'll start with the starting point of the pulp, and then I will take it up to where it goes, like Steve Canyon, Terry and the Pirates. They had movie incarnations, they had feature film incarnations, they had television incarnations, and it goes all the way through. And Flash Gordon, all the way up to the miserable Sci-Fi Channel television series. I really tried to... I was part of the updating process, was to try and get as much information so that it's the kind of book that anyone who's a collector of any pop literature would want to have on the shelf.
What
was nice is when I was writing it, you can't see it, but my apartment is basically the only furniture I have besides this chair and this desk are bookshelves. And so I was able to do about 80% of my research by crossing the room.
So you sleep standing up. Is that what you're saying?
But now... other people don't have to do that. They can pick up my book and get the specific source.
Right.
Made it easier for them.
We look forward to that one. That's going to be great. We're going to segue into, you wanted to keep yourself a little busy while they were preparing
this opus,
the Bold Adventure publication of the Pulp Guy book of pulp heroes. You managed to be invited to submit to 19 anthologies that are expected to come out in 2024. Okay, explain yourself.
Lucy?
You got explaining to do. Okay, I will tell you there is a legend, nigh a myth. In my life, every time I have written a story for an anthology call, say there's an anthology call for a book on Bigfoot, and I write a pitch for it, or I write the full story and I send it in, it's rejected.
Right.
If I've written the full story, I then sell it within a week or two somewhere else.
Right.
This has been consistent. So I'm not terrified of writing for these things. But last year, I was actually invited into 8 anthologies. Most of last year, I didn't get any novel writing done. I did one novel last year because I was writing just short one. Stories. Yeah.
What a layabout. Just one.
But believe me, I would have starved in the days of the pulps. I am an incredibly slow writer. On my best days, 1,500 words. I once did 4,500 words, but I was useless for 2 days. My best day is about 1,500 words. I average, it's gone down to maybe 500 or 600 or 800 words a day, but it's every day.
Right.
And by the time
do those words, if I can insert a question there, 500, 600 words, do they stay more or less the same?
That's the thing is, by the time I'm finished a manuscript, it's already my second or third draft, so it's done.
Right.
Because I loop every day. Right. I read what I did the next day before, I clean it up, and then I move it forward. And I'm on a book now, which is the only thing I can recall in a long time where I worked on it. It wasn't working. I put it aside. I pulled it out again. I reworked it, put it aside. I'm on its third iteration now. Mm-hmm. And it's the only time I've done that. Most of the time, when I write the end, it's the end.
Yeah.
I learned honestly, it's the newspaper man thing.
Right.
Got to get it out. I start at the beginning, I go to the end, there should be minor revisions. Right. And I really try to train myself to do that. So what means is I move a little slowly. I'm always seeing it ahead in my brain so that by the time I get there, I've already made changes in where I am writing.
So looping is some great advice for our friends out there.
Some people say, write fast and get to the end. If you can, that's great. But then you're going to go back and chunk it up.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you can't write so slow that every line must be perfect. So there's a balance. Well, and I've found.
You can if you want to be James Joyce.
Yeah. James Joyce is one of those books you're sentenced to read. Yeah. Nobody has ever sentenced anyone to read Tarzan of the Apes.
See these glasses?
Yeah.
These glasses are because of James Joyce.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's face it. Ulysses was a pointless 40-year travel. But the book,
I tell you what, until I could hear it out loud, I couldn't get it. And a teacher friend of mine was like, yeah, and he was reading this one part. I was the opening of Ulysses. And he was like, yeah, what do you think? You read it. And I'm like, I was struggling. And then he put a brogue on it. And the lilt of it just brang
that is Shakespeare. Honest to God, Shakespeare, I once almost was thrown out of a school because I was doing a lecture series called Saturday Matinee Shakespeare. And the premise was if he were alive today, he would have been writing I Love Lucy, Nightmare on Elm Street, John Wick.
Yeah.
Because he wrote genre fiction. He created genre fiction. And he was able to do that one magic thing, write genre fiction with a soul underneath it. And that's the craft and the art. And
that's the key
in life. That is when I said Shakespeare is not meant to be read. No. You have to hear it.
You have to perform it.
And I performed at many Renaissance fairs and we used to do scenes from Shakespeare and doing the first meeting of Kate and Petruchio, we did it as a sword fight.
Right.
Because she grabs his sword out of his scabbard and says, if I be waspish, then beware my sting. And they duel for the rest of the dialogue. But we did it as this commedia, sexy. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and said, I teach that in my classes. And I never saw how erotic and hilarious it was. And I'm like, how could you miss it? How could you miss it?
That's why we have Teal.
And that's why it should be spoken. And again, going back to Ulysses and my own Gaelic, I consider myself a Shaughnessy.
Okay.
Shaughnessy was the spoken storyteller as opposed to a bard who's supposed to sing it. Right. And there was a very thin line between the two. I read everything I write out loud.
Oh, yeah.
I read it to my writer's group. I read it to myself. And that's my final edit.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't sound right. It won't read right because people are hearing the words in their head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's the best exercise.
Yeah.
Now,
go get him, Chris.
We started on this, what became a literary odyssey, by asking about your anthologies, and you admitted to being invited to 8, and yet we're talking about 19.
Okay.
So there's more to this tale.
Okay. Things like Thrill Ride Magazine, which is an anthology that's probably for a year.
Okay.
They put out their call saying, this is going to be the theme of each of these issues.
Okay.
And most of the time I write for me, and then I try to find a place to sell it.
Right.
I find that allows me to be productive because I'm not straining to write something I don't care about. And sometimes I will write with the idea, I want this to go to this mystery magazine or this other thing, but I still want to write something that I want to write. And so this year, I haven't had anything before. This year, I submitted 3 stories to 3 of the issues, and they took all 3.
Wow.
So that knocked me off. And
all right, that's enough for you.
That's enough for you. No soup for you. And so a couple of them were stories I had in my trunk that a call came up and I went, okay, this is exactly right. And they did take it. So I didn't write it for the anthology. Write for the anthology.
Okay.
But the ones I got invited to, there was a couple of them that were like a real stretch for me.
All right, we'll get back to the stretch in a second. But I want to break in because this is another great thing for our audience to know about and maybe employ. You said the vault, right?
Yes.
So this is a great thing that you taught me. I'm not sure if you know that at all, but you have this file or these files of a printed version of each of the stories that you've written so that if a call comes up,
yeah,
you can go through them. Can you expand and explain that? That's the vault, right?
All right.
It's a great idea for writers to do.
It's instead of sitting around and going, okay, what can I write that fantasy and science fiction will take this month? What do they need? Which is one way to go.
Right.
I write what I want to write. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't know what the genre is till I'm finished it.
Right.
And I write it and I try to send it out. But if it doesn't, it stays in a file. And then over time, sadly, that accumulates. I would love to say everything I write sells. That's not the case. Right. But I'm encouraged by the fact that even Edgar Rice Burroughs, after he was really famous, still couldn't sell stories.
Right.
Yeah, he'd shop it 3, 4, 5 times. He'd start at the highest price and work his way down.
Right.
So that's what I do is I have a file of short stories and novellas that I wrote for me, or I wrote with an idea, but maybe it'll go there and it didn't take it. So it goes off to the corner. I wrote one for an anthology. It didn't sell. I sent it out. And it was taken by Sherlock Holmes Mystery Magazine. It hasn't come out yet. It'll come out sometime this year. But I don't throw anything away. If I cut a paragraph from something, I put it in a file.
Right.
Because
extras
that
file.
Description of a building might be useful at some point or might inspire something. The book that I'm reworking now, I've rebuilt the first 5 chapters of it. And it literally was rebuilding them, going, this explanation's great, but it slows it down here story-wise. I'll put it further in the story. Or he mentions this. I better tell people what that is at this point in a little more detail to try and get, for me, a story has to have a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
You have to feel it. The energy has to flow in a certain way. And if I make you think about something irrelevant to the story, or need an explanation that pauses you reading it, I've failed.
Yeah,
my job is to put you on the roller coaster. And even though sometimes it's slow, but it's always moving. And then
that's one of the things I've found as I've gotten better at editing is that part of the function of editing is to get me out of my own way. Because I don't need those words. I don't need that phrase.
Yes.
I went off on a tangent. You might throw it in the extra file and you might use it somewhere else.
Less is almost always more, even if you're writing a pseudo-Victorian piece. Mm-hmm. I have a series that takes place in the 1890s. And while you want to get the flavor of, you don't want to write Castle of Otranto because no one will freaking read it. So,
You know, Alex is going on the time machine without saying a word this episode.
Yeah, you want to get the flavor. It's like when you do a dialect.
Yeah.
You can't write the whole damn thing in dialect because it becomes unreadable. You can put in a couple of I's and ach, and there you go.
And that's it, yeah.
But if you do the whole thing in Scott's dialect, people are sitting there going, what?
I got a character. I limit him to me, son. That's it. That's all the accent he gets. Now, we'll put a button on your anthologies, and then we're going to turn it over to Alex. Okay.
And then we're going to go back to where he was when we derailed
right, hold him on here. To that for a second. Of the 19 anthologies, how much did your vault help fulfill those?
Probably about half.
Yeah, there you
about
go.
Half. I got the list, you'll see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One is a reprint because they wanted an extra giveaway for the Kickstarter.
Okay. Oh, what an idea that is. Yeah. I may steal an idea.
Who came up with that idea? 6, 7, 8.
Carry the 3.
11 of them were new stories. 12 of them were new stories.
All right.
And the others were from the vault or a story I had previously written, but it's never been published. And one of those technically I wrote this year. That's the one that broke the curse.
There you go.
Before the deadline, Max Gold contacted me, who is a poet, and said, are you going to contribute to this? And I said, I wasn't thinking of it. I figure all the good characters are taken and stuff. He said, I got an idea. And he threw the idea out. And I said, wow, that's actually cool. And he said, I said, what do you want to do? So he started it. He sent like the first 4 or 5 paragraphs to me. Mm-hmm. I read it. We talked. I said, here's where the plot can go. He went, I like it. So I wrote a draft. I sent it to him. But he wrote a draft. We liked it. And we sent it in that day.
Ah.
And they took it. And apparently they said, the editor said, it was his favorite one so far. And it may be the anchor.
Ah, but beautiful.
It wasn't what I was intending to write. It's... Again, because Max is a poet, again, I love language. His stuff is just elegant. Mm-hmm. And he gave a nice elegant veneer to my pulpy plot. And it just worked out. I generally don't like collaborating because I always find I do too much of the work. Every time I've done it, and this was just the most painless, pleasant, and literally it was a day and a half of time and it gone. But it broke the curse. It made the anthology. So hopefully now, when I pitch, I will make anthologies first out of the game.
That's cool. So I guess Teal's going to be just sprinkled all through the calendar.
The hardest one is, I said, there were a couple that stretched me a little further than of my... the direction that I normally would go, but that's good.
Can you elaborate on that?
Endings. Pardon?
Can you say more on that?
Oh, I did one for an anthology called Deep in the Blood, which is a vampire anthology, which is actually cool. Doc Ray Stoker is going to write the foreword to it. But the thing was, no happy endings.
Okay.
I like positive, happy endings. Right. Generally speaking, I like hope. So I had to work a little on it. I finally got one I was very happy with. And the ending was exactly what it needed. Even if it wasn't something I loved, I knew it absolutely worked.
Right.
And then I did one for The Chaos Clock, The Lighthouse at the End of Time.
Okay.
Which is another one that's coming out. And it was cosmic horror and steampunk mixed.
Okay.
And again, cosmic horror generally isn't about resolution. Part of the cosmic horror concept is that we don't matter. Logic and all of the rest of that doesn't work. And that's a little bit opposite my world view. So I had to work on it. It was one of the ones that was hard. Thank God, the story immediately after was a Zorro story I had to write. And I absolutely freaking loved it. Oh, yeah, really. I ended the year with Zorro and I was like, The Rose of Madrid, a story of his youth and love in Madrid. But that one, even though it was for an anthology, and I had been asked into the anthology, this is my second Zorro story from, I would have written that myself. Yeah, okay. It was something. So every once in a while, Right now, I have a character called Jack Silence that when I need to get out, I need to relax, I write a Jack Silence story.
All right.
And he's my go-to fun guy.
We're going to have to talk about Jack Silence in a little bit. Not everybody gets invited. We're all at different parts of. So if you can say a bit of advice on, okay, the process, the grind of submitting until you turns around and you start getting invited.
Wait, you were going somewhere when you started about this, and then you said something that gave Chris the intrigue of wanting to sidestep from him. But I really want you to go back to that point, and I'm trying to remember how you phrased it. It was right around the time you said that I write for me, and there was another remark about looping. It's right there, and I can't pull it. But do you remember where you were?
I don't looping, writing slow, write. I want to write what I want to read mostly, which is, again, why I don't generally like downer endings, because I don't read downer endings. I can watch the news for that. I don't really know where I was at that point.
Then just again, for the sake of the I write what I read, when Chris and I were introducing this segment, we talked about being prolific and how at times people are at a loss for ideas and concepts and or they question it. And you even commented on that at the beginning. When you're writing for yourself or when you're writing material that you want without worrying about whether or not someone's going to accept it, if you're going to get paid for it, if it's going to sell. Is that more liberating or just as difficult?
Oh, absolutely liberating. Oh, my God. If I'm not concerned about whether anybody's going to take it, I pack up my characters, we get in the car, and we drive. But that's one of the reasons my problem is genre boundaries, because I will follow the character wherever he goes. And so as long as it's a character that interests me, I, in theory, can put him in detective stories, adventure stories, love stories, alien, whatever, because it's the character that matters, not what they face or where they face it. And looping back to what Chris was asking at the same time, which connects with this about how to get invited, all I've done is try to put myself out at conferences and online communicating with people. I got one last year from Robert Mendenhall from Codename Intrepid, which is a government Black Hawk type group.
In the
30s and 40s. And he's got it incredibly detailed. I'd never heard of him before. He apparently just followed online what the scuttlebutt was and who was in the pulp world and who was online and who was out there, and just wrote me and said, would you be interested? And it was a challenge because I don't really write military fiction. I do some of it, but I don't have a military background. I've trained military people in martial arts, but I've never actually worn a uniform that didn't look like pajamas. I said, sure. And then that was a hard one to write. Not because it was something that didn't interest me, but because I was writing to, it was an IP that somebody has a very strict Bible for. It was, this character can only call this character that. If you're setting it in this time period, he's a lieutenant colonel. If you're setting it in this time period, he's, and I had to run everything by him. It was great training for hopefully when I get to some real big IP, because it was, I had to read his Bible and a couple of his stories to know exactly how to write his characters and fit it in his world. That came out of the blue. Most of them last year came out of the blue. Some of people I'd met at a conference, some who've actually seen my work online. And that to me says, okay, the work I put in, I'm horrible at publicity. I won't say his name again, because if you say that fellow from the South's name three times, he appears.
That's right. He's good.
He's awesome. He is just, he's a publicity machine. I don't know how he finds time, because he's also a freaking writing machine.
Yeah, yeah.
I suspect that, like that Superman episode, he's been able to divide himself into two. And one does the publicity.
And meld through walls. Yes,
exactly. Really one funny. Does the publicity, well, and one does the writing. But
we're going to have him on. We'll try and remember to ask him about how, is there a second Bobby somewhere? Yeah. It's like a Bobby and a Robbie.
Yeah, there's evil Bobby and good Bobby. Check for the goatee. That's how we know that you're the evil Chris, yeah. Because you don't have.
That's right, I am.
He's, again, for me, it's the consistency. He just keeps doing it. And
I've noticed that you've picked up your presence in social media.
I tried.
You've moved away from some of the frustrations of our reality and been more. Do you have a set of ads that you do for your various books that come out? And then the tone is just slightly different. Was that a conscious thing?
It was conscious to try and get out there. I'm on Blue Sky, but I haven't posted enough on it. I have an Instagram, but I haven't done jack all, and I need to. I recognize that I'm a relic. Nobody under 35 is on Facebook. But on the other hand, Facebook has gotten me half of my work, if not more.
It's also, I think Facebook is where our audience is.
I think where a lot of it is, yeah. And although Instagram seems to work for a bunch of people.
I hear you can sell a lot of books on BookTok. I haven't quite figured that out yet.
There's some guy with a coat who's good on that. He's always going, hey, I got a book for you.
Oh, yeah. That guy. Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't know him because he's dirty faced. So you wouldn't know him. Right. But so I've tried to be more conscious about it because I want to do this.
Right.
I want to do this better. I think I've always been a storyteller. I keep, if I'm at it for another 10 years, maybe I'll be a writer. I want to get better at this. I'm an artist as well. And I was trained as an artist. I went to art school. And the biggest frustration an artist has is you can see it here.
Right.
And you can't get this to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get this hand to make that line the way you want. And I feel the same way with writing.
Yeah.
I know the emotion I want to get through. I know the feeling I want to get from the reader.
Yeah.
But can I find the right words to do it?
Right.
I've been really lucky. I'm going into the fifth year with the same writing group.
Cool.
And they have been incredibly helpful in giving me, did this land? Did this work? Does it work for you? Because you can never proofread your own stuff. You can try really hard.
Right.
You can read it backwards. You can read it out of sync. You can read it upside down, but you're still going to miss something.
Oh, definitely.
And the same is true. I can write something that makes me tear up and totally misses that nobody else feels emotional about it because I know the backstory.
Right.
I know how it's supposed to make you feel. It's incredibly useful to have these other ears, to have people who will look at you. I mean, it's incredibly important. I can't ever say enough how community matters. Writers Association has been an incredible thing to allow me to meet other writers, talk with other writers. And actually, nobody in my writers group is in Horror Writers Association. Yeah. So it's great because it's a completely different group of people.
Wow.
And I was just going to say to quote Avery Brooks, who's somebody, whisper in the right ears.
Yes.
And I would think, again, you're fortunate, as you said, to find a group where this is home.
Yeah.
And it wasn't my first group.
Even brought up finding that group, finding those ears that will not try and have you write what they would write, but are listening to help you improve on you. That's a challenge in and of itself.
And, I was in a group many years ago that was just, it was horrible. I went to two sessions and I couldn't get out of it. Same thing about 3 years ago, I tried another group. Even though I was in this one, I had shied away from groups for years because the first one was so horrible to me. Mm. It was just, they didn't understand what I wrote or why I was writing it. I will tell you, it was a group of science fiction fantasy writers. So I thought I'd be safe there. But I was told, no humor, no sword and sorcery. And I was given a list of things I couldn't write.
That
I couldn't do.
And go ahead for the door immediately.
And then when I got there,
I went out the window.
It was like, it was four women and a gay guy, all of them this complexion, or actually slightly more color than this, but, and every one of their stories was a rape story.
Oh, jeez.
In that one session, this was in the 80s when that was really big. You couldn't sell a story to fantasy or science fiction magazines without some horrible thing happening in the story. And some of them were cross-race stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what the f- is this? And I was, yeah, that was my, I'm out the door. Hmm. The second group I tried about 3 years ago, they just didn't get it. They just, right. They were very literary and very artsy. And I was like, you know, I'm not writing for people who have to have a master's to be able to appreciate writing.
You gotta find your tribe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, like I said, I'm lucky to have found the tribe I have with the group and friends who read my stuff as well.
Yeah. I'm still looking. I don't, I'm not sure if we're having the same experience with HWA. And I'm
this group has been good. We've only had a couple of meetings, though. It has been good. But in general, HWA has been really good for me just because...
Yeah, I have to refigure out what I'm doing and what I'm not doing because I can... It's like you can see it...
And not get there.
But I'm not getting there. And it's good. I got to figure it out. But
for me, part of it is that I never thought of myself as a horror writer. I don't think of I'm a genre writer. I'm a writer. So being told no happy ending immediately limits me and I have to work around it. But I did. And that's fine because every once in a while you can end a story darkly.
Right.
But I just don't want to do that on a regular basis. I'm not just a mystery writer.
Right.
Although I love mystery writing, I'm not a crime writer. I don't actually like to tell it from the point of view of criminals. I'm an action writer. I don't want to do just comedy. I literally change genres from story to keep it fresh for myself.
I gotta tell you,
that's what you do. You tell stories, and where they land or where they're springing forth from is determined as you're building the story.
Yeah, and like I said, last year I was incredibly pleasantly surprised that I had these invitations. Some of it's literally because I met people at horror convention. They've seen my name around. They used to take classes in marketing, and nobody buys something the first time they hear it or see it.
17th time.
Or to quote Jack Albertson, when he asked why he was a success after Chico and the Man, suddenly he said, "I outlived all of the bastard casting directors."
There you go.
You just got to be in it long enough that people go, I guess he must be something. I see his name around. And then if they ask you to do it, turn in a superlative week of piece of work. And then they go, okay, that's why he's still around.
Yep.
So I struggle unless I'm writing it for me, I don't put pressure on myself. But if I'm writing it for somebody else, like the Chaos Clock story or the vampire story, I was like, I got to make this good. And so it is a level of pressure, but is it no professional has no pressure. Now, if you're not a little nervous before you go on stage, no matter how experienced you are, then get out.
All right. What did our boy Bono say in the latest song? If your dreams aren't scaring you, they ain't big enough.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I'm going to segue here. Who'd you write Paradise Investigations for?
Okay.
Segues are us here to tell the damn story, ladies and gentlemen.
Paradise Investigations, the first book is called Not Born of Woman. And it's a book that I wrote for me. I wrote it as a short story. And I said, this isn't a short story. Damn it. I was just doing something to break up in between. Blah, blah, blah. Right. And I just wrote it for me. I had no idea where it was going to go, whatever. I finished it last year. My group was like, oh my God, this is completely different from anything you've ever written. And I didn't know that because it was just writing it. And then I tried selling it, tried marketing it. I think I had 27 turndowns, including a couple of agents who said, love the premise, love the idea, read it, went, eh. And then I sent it out to Crossroads Press.
Okay.
And it was actually out at three different places at once. Within 3 days of each other, all three places asked for it.
Oh, that's a happy problem.
And that weekend, I went to a writer's conference and you could pitch to agents. I said, oh, what the heck? I'll pitch it because I've got a contract. So, I've got interest. So maybe this will help. Both agents said, oh my God, I love it. but then ghosted me. And which is par for the course. I expect that. But then I got a 3-book contract on Not Born of Woman based on 3 chapters and an outline.
Wow. Okay.
It blew my mind.
From whom, if I can ask?
I'll tell you. I'm working my way up to, because it's one of those things where you go, okay, it's 1939. It's 2 weeks after the Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden, where 20,000 Nazis paraded around and 6,000 protesters outside tried to get in to beat the crap out of them. And Adam Paradise, or at least the person who calls himself Adam Paradise, is a private investigator. A young Romani woman who's hunchbacked comes to him and asks him to get back a family heirloom that her brother put up as surety for a bet.
Okay.
And has lost. And the guy won't deal with her because, as she says, always they are saying gypsies are criminals. Romani not criminal. And but the thing is, Adam says, okay, I'll do this, because she's heard that he's takes care of people, that he gives his word, he's good.
Right.
I says, but I'll do it for a home-cooked meal. I haven't had a home-cooked meal in a long time.
It's a good price.
Because Adam, that's not his real, Adam might be his real name, but he's 162 years old. He was assembled by Dr. Victor Frankenstein.
Mm. Oh, yes, I remember this now.
And
yes.
He has come to New York after over 100 years in the Arctic. First, he went to Sweden and then Marseille, and he's come to New York because he's trying to understand his place in the
world.
And what better way to understand humanity than put yourself in a position where people with problems come to you?
Okay.
And he's the ultimate outsider.
Sure.
He is outside every single group. And because of that, he has a completely different perspective. It is written, if you can imagine Chandler having written Frankenstein.
Ah, wow.
Or it's first person, but he'll quote Kant and Giscard d'Estaing and Teilhard de Chardin and Francis of Assisi while he's involved in cases. The quote itself is
a little bit of Robert Parker in there.
A little bit. Yeah. Who is he not born of woman? Him have I to fear or none. That's why it's called Not Born of Woman.
Sure.
Because you better fear him. Because he can see the dead. He doesn't know if they're, he sees shapes. He sees colors. He sees formlessness everywhere, including the ones that hover around him that were the original souls for the parts of his body.
Wow.
And so he can look at you, and if you have black shapes hovering around you or dark indigo shapes, he knows they're connected to you by violence, that you probably killed them, whether you killed them during the war or under the auspices of a police force or whatever. He doesn't know that, but he can tell that. And he goes to the movies because it's the only way he can see how we see the world without those shapes as part of it.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And it's my way to make philosophical comments.
Right.
And propel the story forward, because taking the Chandler concept of he's the knight in modern society, the lone cowboy that private eyes are, he's the ultimate stranger from out of town.
Mm-hmm. Stranger comes to town. Yeah.
Yeah. But he also, he can speak 7 or 8 or 9 languages. In the second book, he's learning Mandarin. And
you've been around that long. Well, what else is there to do but keep learning? Yeah.
Yes. And he's, again, he's trying to, plus we discover, not giving too much away, we discover that the story of Frankenstein was real. Because even Mary Shelley said she based it on a legend she heard about.
Right.
And so in this world, it really was real. And the Romani know it. And at one point they realize, oh my God, that guy.
This is he.
You're that creature outside life who is life. And it's a whole other thing. So
that's fascinating. So Paradise Investigations is the name of the series.
That's the name of the series. The right? Second book is called Like a Walking Shadow. The
first book
is Not Born of Woman.
Not Born of Woman.
Second book is Not Like a Walking Shadow.
Do you have a title for the third book yet?
I do, but I'm not going to give it away yet.
All right, then.
Probably 2 years off.
So when is the first book coming out?
It will be out 90 days after I get the edits, and I'm assuming I will get them somewhere in February or March.
Okay.
But by the middle of this year, that will be out.
Do we have a company?
Oh, yeah. No, it's Crossroads Press.
It is Crossroads.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. I wanted to confirm that.
Yeah, no, I was astounded when they took it. And like I said, they took it on 3 chapters and an outline. And I could not be happier because I wrote this for me.
Sure, of course.
Of course, now the pressure is the second one. God damn it, I got to make it as good as ever. It's probably the best thing I've ever written. And I don't say that because it's me. Everybody who's read it, my friends, say that it is hopefully the next level in what I do.
That is great.
Which has given me another... It's a lot of my personal experience. Every location in the book I've actually been to.
Right.
And a lot of the personal experience, I play the monster, but he's 7'2", and he tells people he was in a car accident to explain the scarring. I went through a windshield.
Yeah. So I have now, besides the anthologies, I love anthologies, but I have the Pulp Guys book of pulp heroes to look forward to, and Paradise Investigations Not Born of Woman to look forward to in 2024. However, we have not finished our business yet, Teal, because if you've noticed, Alex Simmons has been so holding himself back and in such self-discipline and control, it would be a shame and a sin if we did not unleash Alex Simmons to just engage you on any level he wants, because the two of you can go anywhere at any time. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the bonus round, and we turn this over to the pilot of Alex Simmons' Time Machine. Alex Simmons, you and Teal, have at it.
Okay, and I have to say, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to have at it because we're coming close to that time. Let's do it this way. When we started talking about the marvelous volume of stories about pulp heroes, which I also am eager to get my hands on, I quickly looked up the definition of pulp, because there may be people listening to the show that go, what the heck? What are you talking about? Wood chips? And then
originally
I was going to read the definition of pulp and I found it offensive. So I'm not reading that. Oh,
wow.
Yes. The definition of pulp, according to Cambridge, right? The meaning of pulp fiction in English: books about imaginary characters and events produced in large quantities and intended to be read by many people, but not considered to be of very good quality.
Oh, hell with you, Cambridge.
You mean that Dickens fellow, that swine.
That's right.
Let's talk Alexandre Dumas.
Yeah.
Serialized week by week.
Aldrich Berdry. And I probably mispronouncing, but Aldrich Berdry, the science fiction writer, his definition of pulp was a sentimental solution to a complex problem.
Nice.
Intriguing.
And
nicely done.
To me, the definition of pulp is in the negative. It can't be dull. It can't be uninteresting.
Right.
And you should never have to look up a reference book to stop reading the story. Now, considering many of our great literary figures, including Truman Capote, started in pulps.
Right.
I find it, yes, it was popular entertainment, but so was Shakespeare and Dumas. Mm-hmm. And Dickens. And
let us remember that Dickens wrote what? A Christmas Carol in a matter of a couple of weeks?
Yeah, actually weeks, less. Right? I think it was like a week or so.
And it was to make some money immediately.
It was all to make money. He wrote by the word.
He hired himself.
Yeah, here's the thing. I consider pulp to be a roller coaster ride of adventurous and extraordinary circumstances with a hero and a villain usually. And it is a total fantasy fun ride. And ultimately, in most cases, no matter what genre, good triumphs over evil. That's the way I look at it.
Generally speaking, and the thing is, hope is not a genre.
No.
It is, and it's not
a state
really,
of consciousness.
It's not even a style. Hope is a feeling.
Yeah.
And contrary to Pulp Fiction, which really was not pulp, and has really skewed the modern perception of what pulp is.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Tarantino.
Hope is entertaining.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. Yeah. Edgar Rice Burroughs referred to what he wrote as wonderful balderdash. You know,
the whole creation of the word pulp was based on the paper that it was printed on.
It wasn't meant to
limit the style or to
just to make accessible to the public entertainment.
It was printed on that paper so it could be affordable to the masses.
But it's the same difference.
Novels that you could slide into your back pocket. They were digest-sized books that you could slide into your back pocket or your jacket or your coat.
It's the same thing as saying
to work.
Same thing as saying television is the medium, not the content.
Right.
Hope was the medium, not the content.
Right.
The only difference is pulp writers wanted to be in the slicks. Only because the slicks paid more.
Right.
There was no necessarily intellectually superior at all. It was, they paid more. That's why I want to go there. Not because and the fact is, one of the problems we have with people reading or not is because we force them to read books which have been deemed intellectually or culturally valuable by academics who are not part of the mainstream of society.
Right.
So you're forcing people to read stuff that they wouldn't read, given a choice. That's actually literally the way to stop people from doing anything.
And they've been successful.
Yes, they have.
And there is a revolution if one wants to look at it that way. It's not one of my favorite genres or categories, but very much reflective of what we're talking about, which is street novels.
Yes.
Because that's, again, written for the masses.
That's the next evolution.
Right. And we have a lot of the independently published via the internet material, which is another way of getting those stories out to...
It's the modern pulp.
More. Right, exactly.
It's why, actually, the term new pulp is incredibly applicable, but not to just our, writing 30s characters. It really, new pulp is applicable to all publishing done electronically and digitally. It is.
New pulp, classic pulp.
Pulp. I think most of the stuff. Yeah. I think Soul Scream was pulpy. I think most of the characters I write are pulpy. It's just.
Blackjack's definitely pulpy.
Yeah. But again, none of that is quality judgment.
No.
And it is simply flavor. It's horror is a flavor. Anything can have horror, suspense, you sprinkle it into it.
Right. It's like a little salt or a little pep up.
As one of our previous episodes talked about.
And the thing is that something like Soul Scream is a conscious effort to evoke the emotions that you would get from, say, the spider pulps or Weird Tales pulp. But at the same time, writing stories for people now. So there is no one type of story. It's all screams.
No, my food analogy would be when we had family parties or someone graduated, we'd always have buffet style. And you always try and get a bunch of different tastes, but it's always just, we love you being here, enjoy.
So you're saying
that's really what Soul Scream was.
Yeah.
So, but without using that word.
Because it's hard to spell.
That was a time machine moment there, only because we have to ring it. We have to close the door, turn the dials off, because we've run out of time. But of course, as always, because he has his own pass key, Teal will return.
Yes, he will.
We will do this again and again.
Jason.
Yes.
as Pulp Guy comes out, as Paradise comes out, I'd love to have that. Would be cool.
And I've also got a collection called Fey Noir. coming out in June. God, maybe before God. That, but Proces promised me by June for sure, maybe.
So we're thinking you've got two books coming out around June.
It looks like I'll
it
have...
It looks like. Ooh, nice.
Like the middle of this year, it's got to be wacky.
Will that be under your imprint?
Yes, from Proces. Yeah, Proces.
And what is the name of your imprint?
Glenn's Other Wen.
There you go.
The Glenn's Other Wen imprint. There's
I just love that I know somebody with their own imprint.
Hey, this is for good and this is for evil, the imprint.
love, hate.
Exactly. This is the friend of the Phantom and this is the enemy of the Phantom.
We're pulling from that one, from Fox.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm going. but I'm incredibly blessed that I have a number of publishers that I can work with. I know I've got a couple like things coming out from Airship 27 again in anthologies from them. I just of my publishers don't actually give me a date, which is why I'm happy with Crossroads. They just like when the stuff comes in, we get it together, and I might only get 2 weeks' notice. Right. Crossroads Press in the contract, which is really nice, says from 90 days from when we get the finished edit, we're looking to get it out around the time. Good. Which is why I want to move up, because the big boys have those kind of production schedules. Unfortunately, smaller publishers are usually a staff of one or two. And yeah, I want to work for publishers where the entire staff won't die in a single car crash. So
the whole company shot to hell.
Unless they rent the bus.
That one, right?
You know, little black guys on the driveway. That company's done.
It happened. Hey, it's happened to me. I've had publishers die. So that's the goal, but it doesn't really matter because I'm just going to keep writing because that's what I do.
And that's a great fade out on the original premise, which was how can one be so prolific and productive? Part of that message is you write for yourself. It's less inhibiting, but also you found ways to address rejection. You found ways to be consistent, and you've also found ways, because it matters to you, to always work to improve your craft.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If something gets rejected, I might take a day, but it'll go right out again.
Yeah, you go. You know, okay.
I keep doing it till somebody tries to stop me.
And Chris will be there when they do.
I know. Yep. The Nunzio baseball bat ready to go.
That's right. Hey, how are you doing? What are you doing? Hey,
I'll bring Leon with me. Okay, yeah. So guys, it's great having a wonderful time, a wonderful session with you again. Chris, as always, absolutely. Love you, man. Thank you for coming back.
We would close down the bars easily.
Oh, and easily.
Just by walking in, they'd say, nope, we're closed. Get out of here.
That's it. Oh, no.
So everybody, you know, please leave your comments, your likes. Oh, press that. What is it? Click that. What is that? What are they doing, Chris? They're supposed to.
You have to smash the like and click subscribe.
There you go.
And if you got a question for Teal, ask it. Just another excuse to bring them on.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, take care, everybody.
Peace.
Be well. Thanks. Live long with prostate.
There you go.